Genesis 22, as Abraham tested, is the headline.
On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father."
"Yes, my son," Abraham replied.
"The fire and wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took his knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you've not withheld from me your son, your only son." Abraham looked up, and there in a thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." Then Abraham returned to his servants, and they set off together for Beersheba, and Abraham stayed in Beersheba.
Thank you. I can still remember the day when I was a child about that high, when I first heard that story, and I think I had a full head of hair, and I think it stood up. On the 8th of December, 1936, the then Prime Minister, Stanley Baldwin, instructed his valet to pack an overnight bag. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then he instructed his chauffeur to drive him with the bag to Fort Belvedere, which was the house in Windsor Park that the King, Edward VIII, had made his home. Now, Baldwin was one of those politicians who had an unerring instinct for public opinion. And he knew that the British public at that time would not stand the idea of their king marrying an American divorcee. American and divorcee together. That was all too much. And he feared that if it went ahead, the monarchy might fall. And so he was trying to persuade the king, either he must abdicate and then he can marry, or he must stay king but not marry. The king himself, however, had a strong dislike of Stanley Baldwin because the king wanted to have his cake and eat it, both to marry Wallace Simpson and to remain king. So Stanley Baldwin was coming on that date, 8th of December 1936, for a final showdown with the king. Well, when Stanley Baldwin's Daimler car drove up, the king came to the front door, saw Stanley Baldwin and the overnight bag, and was horrified. The thought that he would have to spend the whole evening with this man and meet him again over breakfast was more than he could stand. So the king blurted out, "Yes, I'll abdicate. And Stanley Baldwin went to just make sure that that's what he really meant. They shook hands. Stanley Baldwin went off back to London. And 3 days later, the king abdicated, all to avoid having breakfast with Stanley Baldwin. Now, that's not the only incident when a wise prime minister has saved the monarchy from itself. Just over a century previously, in 1820, the Prince Regent, after whom all Regent streets and Prince Regent's pubs are named, the Prince Regent became King George IV. Now, George IV was estranged from his wife, Caroline of Brunswick. So much so that she had gone back to Brunswick, which I think is in modern Germany, as she's so fed up with the king, with the Prince Regent, as he then was, and he himself had carried on a very adventurous love life here in Britain. Well, as soon as George became George IV, Queen Caroline wanted to come back and get her share of the crown, of the throne. So she hastened back to England. But the king wanted nothing to do with her. So he persuaded Parliament to pass a bill to the effect that Queen Caroline couldn't become queen because she was an adulteress. Well, the British public were somewhat surprised at this. She may or may not have been an adulteress, but the king undoubtedly was an adulterer. So it was rank hypocrisy. Now, there was a growing movement anyway against the monarchy and against the whole aristocracy, a growing republican movement and a democratic movement here in Britain. The Peterloo massacres had taken place only a year previously. And the Prime Minister, Lord Liverpool, was worried that Queen Caroline and her estrangement would prove a catalyst for some sort of revolutionary movement. Indeed, Caroline had become something of a hero to the Republicans. She was against the monarch, they were, she must be good. So, as I say, Lord Liverpool was worried about some sort of insurrection, possibly even an English revolution like the French Revolution only a few decades previously. So he wanted to calm things down. And he decided the best thing to do was to delay the coronation indefinitely, because he feared that would be like the fall of the Bastille, that could be the trigger. Now, the king was very angry about this, but Lord Liverpool was insistent the coronation must be delayed. Well, a year went past, and actually public opinion began to cool towards Caroline of Brunswick. And so Lord Liverpool, in July 1821, decided the coronation could indeed go ahead. Now, Caroline was furious at this, furious at the idea that she wouldn't be there to be crowned. So she turned up at the Abbey on the coronation day, but every door of Westminster Abbey was bolted and barred with armed guards in front of it. And she bashed on the door, she screamed, she shouted, but she couldn't get into the Abbey and be crowned. Well, far from being on her side, public opinion now was rather against her, and they treated her not even with sympathy, but with derision. And the poor woman went back to Germany, a sad and a broken woman, and died only a year later. A rather sad story. Well, just to mention one other Prime Minister, not so popular these days, and that I did do sterling service for the monarchy for in a similar wobble, was Tony Blair, who helped the monarchy through its most recent major wobble, namely the death of Princess Diana. And the previous year, John Major had been a fine servant of the monarchy over the mess of Charles and Diana's divorce. So prime ministers can be good for monarchs. That seems to be one of the lessons. Now, all these stories that I've told about the monarchy tell us something rather strange about the British way of being royal, how monarchy works within our country. Now, if the Queen were to announce that next Sunday she was going to attend worship at the Stamford Free Church, I can guarantee we would all spend the next week scrubbing and polishing the church within an inch of its life. Every wall would be redecorated, the lavatories cleaned so they shone like silver. Everything would happen like that. We'd all be polishing our shoes, and then we'd be practicing our bows or our curtsies. I'm not going to imitate one because I'd fall over. But I'm sure you ladies know how to curtsy, because just in case she shook us by the hand, we would know what to do. The Queen's mystique is extraordinary and huge. She carries great status, great authority. She's a major personage in our lives. And yet, imagine the situation, God forbid, that public opinion did turn decisively against the monarchy, and only sort of 20% supported the monarchy, 80% wanted to get rid of it. The monarchy would simply collapse. That mystique would evaporate like the morning mist. The royal family would just become an ordinary family like ours. In other words, the Queen is the monarch, but she rules by consent. Now, that's a strange and a wondrous thing. If you ever get fed up with our politicians, and you might occasionally get fed up with them, just look at how the monarchy works and what a miracle it is. It's a monarchy by consent. What a miracle.
A wondrous thing.
Now, in the Bible, there are various images to describe God's relationship with the universe and with mankind. But one of the images, the one that Jesus uses most, is that of kingdom, kingship. God is king and we are subjects. And God is an absolute ruler. Go out into the garden there and you can see his laws being obeyed to the nth degree. The insects, the leaves, the flowers, the grass are all behaving just as God ordains. The laws of nature are immutable and nature obeys them. So in regard to nature, God is indeed an absolute monarch. But there is one creature, one species, that he only rules by consent. He's chosen that, but that's how he rules. And that species is us. We can consent to God or not, as we choose. And it's a real choice, because generally speaking, it's rather more attractive not to assent to God, but stick to one's own desires and wills, and do what one wants. So it does take an effort, a real effort, actually takes the grace of God, to consent to God. But it's a choice, it's a real choice. And the reason why he gives us that choice, we find that in Genesis, he wants us as his companions. Now, if you were simply mindless subjects like the insects out there, we wouldn't be real companions of God. The essence of God, or part of the essence, is he makes choices. He chose to make the universe as he is. So being free to choose is of the essence of us, because God is calling us to be his companions. We have to be like him. And we can be his companions if we choose, if we consent. He is a king by consent of us as human beings. Now that is quite an extraordinary thought, and yet it's absolutely true. Now that raises the question, how can we know exactly what God is wanting us to do? What does it mean to make him an absolute ruler of our lives? Now in some instances it's perfectly clear. If you found that I was regularly committing adultery, stealing, murdering, all that kind of stuff, you could be fairly certain I was not obeying God's will. I think that's clear. The Ten Commandments are a pretty good start. But how about those incidents, constant ones, that we're constantly facing when it's not absolutely clear? Should I go and see that person, have a chat? Or might I make things worse? Should I volunteer for that job? Or perhaps not, I might put someone's nose out of joint. Should I have that last chocolate biscuit in the tin? The answer is probably no. Actually, that's a spoil-sport thing to say. We are constantly facing choices where we don't know quite what is right or wrong. It's part and parcel of being a human being. None of us, in all instances, knows exactly what God is wanting us to do. Now, if you're like me and a worrier, what happens is you wake up at 2 a.m. with one of those choices on your mind, and you start tussling, and your arms and your legs get more and more tense, you toss and you turn, you think, what should I do? This goes round and round in your mind, and sleep becomes more and more elusive. But then if you're me, something rather odd's happening in all that. At some point you say, perhaps I ought to ask God about this. But you don't. There's a stubbornness about us. We know we should ask God, but we don't. And so I go round and round saying, actually, I should ask God. I'll get his guidance here. But I don't actually ask for it. Does that sound familiar to some of you? Yes, it does. Now, I had a rather strange incident several weeks ago, and it's repeated, which may be of some help. I don't know. I was in that state, and I can't for the life of me remember what the issue was. Utterly trivial, probably. But I was going round and round in my mind. And I was saying, I need to ask God about this, I need to ask God, and wasn't. And then finally, through the grace of God, I said, Father, please. That's what I said. I think I said it out loud. But it feels in my memory it was out loud. And then, quite extraordinarily, in my mind, I was transported to a particular bench overlooking the River Cam. I walked past it quite frequently in Cambridge. And on this bench, there was an old man. Cloth cap, very, very thin, wearing a kind of shirt and a jacket, an old jacket, an old overcoat. And I can absolutely vivid this. He was wearing grey flannel trousers with turn-ups. There he was sitting there with a walking stick. And I knew he was an angel sent by God. He was an angel from the Father. In a sense, he was the Father, but an angel sent by the Father. And I sat down beside him. And I began to talk about the thing that was troubling me. And he listened and smiled and listened and smiled. And then he put his hand on my forearm and said, "Robert, don't worry about that. I'll tell my son about it. He'll sort it." The tension went away. I dropped off to sleep, and he did sort it. That little experience I've just described has been a huge blessing to me, and it's recurred in different ways. And sometimes I wonder, am I really actually deluding myself? Is this these visions, are they something of my generation? But I'm comforted by the fact that the great Spurgeon, Charles Spurgeon, the great preacher, was also a believer in what he called nightly visitations. God does come. His angels come. They do guide us. So if we do ask for God's guidance on something, he will bring it. It might just come through an intuition. You feel, that's right. Or it might come through a vision. All sorts of different ways it can come. But somehow, the way we know God's will is so easy. We just need to turn to God and ask for it. And he will give it. And we're so stubborn, we don't turn to him. So always the will of God is plain if we just ask God for it. Now, coming back to the abdication, the king's mother, George V's wife, as you may recall from your history, was Queen Mary. Yes, Queen Mary. A very tall, statuesque woman. And didn't smile much. I think she was from Germany, and the Germans aren't tremendous smilers. She was not a barrel of laughs. And very, very serious, and very, very virtuous on the whole. But she had a weakness. And the weakness was this. That for her summer holidays, she'd have a holiday away from the king and away from the royal, on her own. And she would choose a county of England and invite herself to stay for a fortnight in one of the grand stately homes of that county. Couldn't say no. Queen Mary turned up. But she also invited herself for tea each afternoon at another stately home in the county. And so each afternoon after lunch, the Rolls Royce and two flunkies would drive off with the Queen to one of the stately homes around that county. Now, sometime, I think in the early 1930s, Dorset was the chosen county for Queen Mary. And she stayed in a stately home, I don't know which one, but one of the homes she was going to visit for tea was West Stafford House. Which is an absolutely exquisite Elizabethan stone-built, quite small manor house, but absolutely lovely. Currently the home of, I forgot his name, the Downton Abbey writer, Julian... Hello. That's right. But then the home of a man called Sir Philip Egerton, who was very bald, like me, but with a huge lump on his head, paralytically shy, and a bachelor. I don't think he'd ever managed to talk to a woman in his life, sort of straight on. Couldn't look them in the eye. And so he was terrified at the idea of the Queen coming to spend tea with him. You know, what would he say? He'd never said anything. So he asked my granny to come and be hostess. She lived about 2 miles away, and granny enthusiastically agreed. And granny had that same gift that the Queen seems to have of being able to talk endlessly about almost nothing. So ideal for the situation. So the afternoon arrived. And the Queen Mary turned up, got out of the Rolls Royce, went into the house, tea was had, conversation went on, Sir Philip said absolutely nothing, sort of, and Granny sort of burbled away, and the Queen burbled back, or the other way around, I think. The Queen burbled, Granny burbled back. And so it all went well. And then, after the thinly cut cucumber sandwiches and nice little cakes had been consumed, the Queen said, "Sir Philip, may I look round your house?" And of course, and so they off they went round the house, and every room she came to, she would look round it, and she would say, "Ooh, that thing there, ornament or whatever it might be, or picture on the wall, that's rather nice, isn't it?" And the drill was, what you had to say is, "Yes, Your Majesty, it'd be an honour if I could present it to you." "Oh," said the Queen, "how kind!" And she would indicate to one of her flunkies to go and collect the ornament and take it to the boot of the Rolls Royce. And according to Granny, on that particular afternoon, she got about 20 or 30 objets d'art that were in the boot of the Rolls Royce. All those things, along with things given by stately homes all round the country, are presumably now in the royal collection. Now, when Granny told me this story, I was outraged that the Queen was allowed to behave in this sort of way. Now, how could you go around sort of taking people's objects like that? But Granny took exactly the opposite view. I think Granny believed in the divine right of kings. You know, if you're a queen or a king, you can just do what you like. And so, as far as she was concerned, Queen Mary was perfectly justified in taking what she wanted. But then Granny added this. But Sir Philip was quite happy to give it. In other words, it was by consent, ultimately. Sir Philip could have said to the Queen, no, I'm not giving you that. And there's nothing she could have done about it. In other words, Sir Philip was in some way consenting, however outrageous the thing was that he was consenting to. And that's what that passage in the Bible that Janet read to us. It was outrageous that God could ask Abraham to sacrifice his son. Utterly outrageous. But Abraham had to be willing to do it, even if in the end he didn't need to do it. He had to be willing. He had to give his consent, even to something that by any standards was outrageous, because God was asking it. And that's the big thing for us. God is saying to each one of us, do you consent to my rule, or do you not consent to it? And on our answer to that question, everything else in our lives depends.